Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
If you are sharing and doing your fair share, and you are watching other people who are benefiting to a greater extent than you are by basically being out for themselves at others' expense, you start to feel like a sucker. You know, if everybody's going to be doing their share, then people usually don't have a hard time motivating themselves to do their share, or at least there's a tremendous move in that direction.
That's the voice of economist Robin Hinnell. This is segment 2 in a 4-part series about the economy. On this week's show, we talk about progressive movements and the compatibility of having a social economy side by side with a capitalist economy. So stay tuned.
We are listening to Latin Waves. We're very privileged to be joined by Dr. Robin Hinnell. Dr. Robin Hinnell is an economist and a very cherished contributor to Latin Waves. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you.
Now, we've been talking about what an economy is. We ended our last segment talking about the gains and the advancements that, you know, social movements have achieved in Latin America, particularly the case of Venezuela. And we ended the segment talking about the role of transforming not just the economy, but the kind of economy that we create. Your last words were populist redistributive capitalism cannot be sustainable. I'd like to pick up that conversation and perhaps talk a little bit about the structures that form and sustain an economy that is participatory, that allows redistribution of wealth to be equitable and sustained over a long time.
How do you organize an economy so that it will perform well for ordinary people? And my fundamental answer has been that you have to figure out how you can put ordinary people in charge of the economy. One whole vision is the elites will run the economy because it's too complicated for ordinary people to actually manage, control, and make decisions. Elites are going to have to do it. Now, if the elites are doing it, there's two possibilities. They'll run it in a way that serves their interests, even if it doesn't serve the interests of other people. Or you can hope that you will have an elite basically committed to running things in a way that's going to be to the benefit of ordinary people. I think as soon as you phrase it that way, as soon as you understand what that second option is, it's easy to see why it is a dangerous and unstable option. Because as long as the elites are controlled, they can always move in the direction of doing less and less to make decisions to serve the interests of ordinary people and to do more and more to serve their own interests. You can think of it in terms of social movements. So in Latin America, 21st century progressive movements basically pioneered a new strategy. We're going to build up large social movements and popular organizations. But these are not electoral vehicles. These aren't electoral political parties. These aren't elected politicians. We are also going to work with elected politicians and political parties because out in the streets, street heat essentially can create conditions for changes in economic decisions. But unless you have people who've been elected to government and government officials who are making the changes that are dictated by the masses of people in these social or in these social movements, then you actually don't win anything. So Latin America pioneered, first we built social movements, and then we engage in political activity, and we elect politicians to start doing the bidding of the social movements. And that was always a difficult interface. What's the relationship between the elected politicians and the political parties and the social movements? And scads has been written on this subject. How do the politicians continue to sort of do what the social movements want? And I think one of the things we're observing is that 30 years of social movements electing others to serve their interest as the elected politicians has taken its toll. It takes its toll in the most obvious way in terms of corruption, that elected politicians simply become corrupt. The more important thing is that the elected politicians sort of, they lose contact, and this is another thing that's often noted. Well, they lose contact with the masses. You know, they're elected and they go off and they sit in meetings and somehow they forget where they came from. They forget what they were supposed to do. Well, this is a problem with the strategy. On the other hand, I think it's a problem we have to figure out, you know, better ways of coping with. In the end, we don't want to have to rely on elites, even if they began as elites that were serving the interests of the social movements. You want the social movements actually making the decisions themselves. That's the only thing that's safe in the long run. But in the meantime, we do. I don't think we're going to go back to the days of guerrilla revolutionary armed revolt, you know, in underdeveloped countries as the way to overthrow imperialism and capitalism and to build socialism. I think that Latin America has basically demonstrated that the route to eliminating capitalism in the 21st century is one that's going to start with stronger and stronger social movements. It's going to go through a phase where we're going to elect political parties that will start to implement policies that benefit people, and thereby we increase our strength and confidence. But at some point, we have to figure out how it is that we're no longer relying on elites, even if they are our own political elites and elected political elites, to make the decisions for us. We have to make that next step that nobody has made, or else we are at risk of being, we're at risk of rollback, and that's the kind of thing that we are now observing under somewhat more difficult global conditions in Latin America right now.
So what are the institutions that are intricately defining and regulating how that economy of a particular country functions? For instance, you know, the system of taxation, the system of production. How do we engage with those questions in a way that are accessible? Because part of the reason why we have elites running economies is because we are told economics are too complicated, you know, we need a simple tax system, we need, you know, and there's all these ways that we distance ways of knowing and seeing the world in order to create privilege and privilege in hierarchies that continue to recreate the same forms of domination, repression, and oppression that reinstate inequality and injustice over and over and over.
Let's look at what they did in Venezuela. I think the strategy was actually very, very good up to a certain point. Chavez did not originally say that he was opposed to capitalism. He said he was opposed to neoliberal capitalism. He was opposed to the kind of capitalism that doesn't work for 85% of Venezuelans. And he said, I'm serious and I'm going to do something about it. So the first phase was populist and redistributive. The people who were most benefited by the reforms of the first 3 or 4 years of the Chavez government. I lived and worked in Venezuela 2 or 3 different times for short periods. And what I came to understand was we're talking about a woman in her 30s or her 40s who is certainly largely of African descent, who is a single mom and who is living in a slum. And Chavez benefited those women and their families in very palpable ways. They got health care. They got food at prices they could afford. They got educational opportunities, both for themselves in terms of adult literacy and for their children. These were tremendous improvements in human lives. What those women came and said to the Chavez government at a certain point was, we appreciate this. We've got your back. If the oligarchy tries to overthrow you, we will go in the streets. We will not put up with that because we know this is the first government that has ever done anything for us and our kind of people. But you know what I need now? I need a job. And at that point, the private industry and the private sector in Venezuela was still completely in the hands of either foreign multinational companies or in the hands of a very reactionary political bourgeoisie, which was doing everything it could to sabotage the economy and create conditions that would get Chavez out of power. So the thing he did at that point was he said, yes, well, the next step is we need to give these people jobs. And we're going to give them jobs in a new form of political organization. We're going to help them organize workers' cooperatives. Because A, the state sector can't hire them all, and B, the private sector is refusing to. So we're going to go ahead and have a massive program to create workers-owned and managed cooperatives that these kinds of people who have become engaged in the political revolution can get involved in. And it was a very good idea, and they did. They created tons of cooperatives. There was huge international criticism. Oh, but the failure rate of your cooperatives is so high. You're making loans. You're going out and organizing people to set up their own businesses and go to work, and you're making loans to these businesses and get off the ground, but it's very difficult to train people and give them the accounting skills that they need in order to do this. You have huge failure rates. And I thought Chavez's answer was brilliant. He said, you know what's important? What's important is not how many fail. What's important is how many actually don't fail. And I'm going to create lots and lots so we have many, many that don't fail. So they did that for 2 or 3 years, and it was a big step forward. And notice that it also moves us from I am using oil revenues to give you healthcare clinics to I am actually empowering you to be a productive person and make decisions about how it is you go about working. The problem with that was that it bogged down. And in part, it bogged down because of tremendous opposition from the private sector. In part, it bogged down because it is a difficult process. It's difficult to give people the skills they need so that they can actually set up and run their own factories and their own businesses. And it also failed because there was never an answer to the question, but how do these little co-ops and the new communal governments that are making the political process much more participatory and democratic, how do they actually coordinate amongst themselves? They never figured out a way. How can we have some sort of democratic planning of this new economy that we've created? They had a name for it. They called it the social economy. And they said, we have the private economy, we have the old state sector, such as the oil company, and we now have our new social economy that's made up of these people's communes and of these workers-owned cooperatives, and all these health clinics and these food stores that are in the poor neighborhoods. That's our social economy. Well, at some point, that social economy had to grow and it had to consolidate because you can't just create it and have it sit there. It's going to go one way or the other. And that is, in my opinion, where the failure came in, that after making all these forward steps, there was simply a point that was reached where the social economy was no longer growing, it wasn't consolidating, and instead it was stagnating. And when it started to stagnate, that's when the political power of the oligarchy started to increase because they still had control of their part of the economy. The government did not go ahead and aggressively say, now we have a social economy that's up and running. It works better for people than the private sector does. We're going to replace the private sector with a social economy. That's going to be the economy for the whole country. They needed to move in that direction. For a lot of reasons, it's difficult. But I think what we're seeing is the consequences of that failure. And when I say that failure, I don't mean that it was necessarily a failure of the political leadership even. It was a failure to do something. When you lose that forward momentum, at some point, the momentum is going to turn back in the other direction. And that's what started to happen and has continued to happen, unfortunately.
So can we talk a little bit then about the structure that, because as you point out, we have a social economy that was started, but there seems to be a need for a kind of a structure way to keep moving that momentum into something that it becomes sustained on its own effort. You know what I mean? That it becomes the new normal, because that's how capitalism gets sold to us. It's just normal. You know, if you're going to have an economy, it has to be capitalism.
Part of the reason momentum is so important is, what is it that motivates people in the social economy? Well, basically two things. What motivates them is, we're making the decisions. We're not carrying out decisions that an employer has made, or, you know, that a government bureaucrat has made. We're making the decisions ourselves. And so when we decide to do things, then that's the incentive and the motivation people have to go ahead and get them done. The second thing that motivates people in the social economy and motivates people in these co-ops is, well, you know, there's a lot of work that isn't very pleasant, but somebody's got to do it, but we're going to share it. We're going to share the burdens of doing the unpleasant things that have to be done for all of us to be able to have the things that we want. So it's sort of a growing sense of what's fair when we're distributing sort of the burdens of economic activity. There's a growing sense of, we're going to do that fairly, and that's why I do my fair share. That's why I show up even when it's hard to get out of bed, because I understand that if I don't do that and then somebody else doesn't do that, it isn't going to work. Those are the things that motivate people in the social economy, the economy of the future. Now, those aren't the things that motivate people in the capitalist sector. In the capitalist sector, it's basically people out after their own individual benefit at the expense of others. So it's very difficult to have those two systems coexist. If you are sharing and doing your fair share, and you are watching other people who are benefiting to a greater extent than you are by basically being out for themselves at others' expense, you start to feel like a sucker. You know, if everybody's going to be doing their share, then people usually don't have a hard time motivating themselves to do their share, or at least there's a tremendous move in that direction. But if people see others not doing their share and taking advantage, then it's very difficult. It's more difficult to get people to do their fair share in the economy. And I think that's one of the reasons that allowing that private sector with its wholly different ethos, it's a dog-eat-dog world, and the losers are the losers and the winners are the winners. That's the ethos. That's the way of life in capitalist economies. If you don't want that to be the way the economy works, you have to set up an economy that works on different principles. But thinking you can have the two coexist, I think, is a lesson to be learned that, once again, from Venezuela, we've discovered that, no, it's either going to go one way or another. People are either going to start behaving one kind of way, or they're going to start behaving the other. You can't have sort of half the people doing one and half the people doing other. That's something that is not sustainable.
Now, in terms of having an economy that functions, can we talk about the role of diversity within an economy that is productive and that fulfills the needs of most people?
I'll put it this way. All economic research indicates that when people have more say over how things should be done, then the people who do those things are more productive. If you increase participation, you almost always increase productivity. Now, that's a huge advantage. If we're talking about workers-owned co-ops, it means that as long as those workers-owned co-ops are being run in a way where people are effectively participating in the decision-making, then there's every reason to believe, from all the economic evidence we have, that they will be more productive. They'll be more dedicated to getting things done. When a problem comes up at work, there's two attitudes I can have. One is, it's not my problem. Somebody else is going to have to solve it. I sort of look the other way. And the other attitude I can have is, ooh, this problem's come up. We've got to do something about that. Well, that means I have to do something about that. Well, the evidence indicates that when people are more involved in participating in the decision-making process, they're more likely to take that second attitude and not the first attitude. So that's part of the reason that there is, I think, an inherent advantage in terms of how well the economy can operate. If it's not operated when employers are just telling people what they have to do and people are doing as little as they possibly can and still collect their wage rate. When you think about it, does that sound like a recipe for a productive economy? It doesn't. It's amazing that the proponents of capitalism have basically claimed that that's the best way to run an economy for all these years. The other part of the problem is most people have lived their entire lives in a context where they weren't supposed to be making economic decisions. They were being told that somebody else is supposed to be making these decisions for them. So that's a huge change in people's attitude. And it's not just a question of technical education and providing people with courses in accounting. It's also a sort of a political education that has to counter literally centuries of people being told that they're not really capable of making good economic decisions. Then the other thing you have to do is you have to set up sensible procedures so that people, ordinary people, can make good economic decisions. And that's where you have to come up with some system of coordinating all of these workers-owned enterprises and consumers and neighborhoods. You have to figure out some way of coordinating them so that it doesn't take a tremendous amount of their time, it doesn't overtax them, it provides them with the necessary information to make simple decisions about, yes, we prefer this to that, here are the options, here are the consequences, here's the vote, we're done, moving on. You have to figure out ways to do that. And that's something that socialist revolutionaries and leadership of anti-capitalist movements, you know, quite frankly, haven't really provided people with answers that everybody's agreed on.
I love your response that when people feel engaged, when people feel included, they're more apt to take, you know, responsibility over creating something that collectively benefits the whole. And I'd like to leave our conversation for this segment there, because I think that this really is a nice platform to jump into our third segment, which is what are the barriers that prevent, you know, this ability to co-create. So we'll leave it there for now. Thank you so much for being with us.
We're going to finish today's show with a song by Dana Lyons called My Tiny Room. Thanks for listening.
There are flowers on my windowsill, and everyone looks like the sun. The sun is within everyone, I can see the whole world from my tiny room. There are bees in the flowers, rolling in pollen and fun. The sun is within everyone, I can see the whole world from my tiny room. There are children out my window. They laugh and they squeal as they run. The sun is within everyone, I can see the whole world from my tiny room. There are soldiers out my window, all of them daughters and sons. A sun is within everyone. I can see the whole world from my tiny room. There are planes out my window with weapons that shine like the sun, where all life is fragile and one. I can see the whole world from my tiny room. See God out my window, and I see that God shines like the sun. Another spring day has begun. I can see the whole world from my tiny. There are flowers on my windowsill, and everyone looks like the sun. The sun is within everyone. I can see the whole world from my tiny.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.